Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Again, has to be careful of the speed.
What a comeback season for Hal Sutton.
Come right back toward the hole.
Come on in. That's the second eagle he's made it for this week.
17 years later, Hal Sutton is the Players' Champion.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. Really excited about our next guest, Mr. Mike Shy, longtime coach of Bryson DeChambeau. He's the director of instruction at the Dragonfly Golf Club out in Fresno, California. Been my honor to spend a few years traveling around on tour with him and Bryson doing some 3D stuff. Got to know Mike pretty well over the years. Mike, it's an honor to have you on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. I'm excited about being with one of my idols for sure.
You weren't talking about me though, right?
I mean, you definitely got in there because we made you do some unique things. That's for sure. You had to jump through some small hoops and you did it.
So Mike, let's get right into this. Tell us about the single length irons. Where did that start? And help us.
Yeah, sure. Bryson, he was hitting balls one day and he looks over at me and he said, why do I have to have variable length clubs? And a lot of that was due to some of the swing characteristics that we were going through, which most people would say that one plane, we called it a zero shift motion. So we figured out that for the most part, trying to have variable planes. In fact, he was really funny because I said, yeah, your posture should be about the same for everything, right? And he went out, he was pretty ticked. He went out and he videoed 13 swings, right? Driver all the way down to lob wedge. Brought his video back and said, see, look, I got 13 different swings. I don't want that. And so, and again, I never said no to him. So basically I said, you know, that's a very easy question to ask about having clubs the same length, but a difficult one to answer. But we did some research. We figured out that we needed a head weight that was, let's say, a 280 grams. I wasn't a big swing weight guy anyway. I've never really been a big swing weight guy. I know that kind of ticks off the club makers a little bit. I'm into more performance than anything. But anyway, so we figured about 280 grams for the head. All we had were 6-iron dynamic gold shafts. I had a set of, let me go backwards just a little bit. I had Henry Griffiths. I had a 5-iron, an 8-iron, and a sand wedge. I said, this is going to feel awful, but you'll get the idea of how weird it is looking at a 37-inch sand wedge. But he went out and he hit him. He went, okay, that's kind of cool. And then we went to the next level. I had a set of Nike cavity backs, and we figured we had to add tons of lead tape on the longer irons or the less lofted clubs. And then we had to take a lot of weight off. The clubs that had more loft. So we made everything at 280. We destroyed the integrity of the clubs. And so he went out and hit a few shots, said, okay, this is cool. Played one hole, normal 8-iron. He said, well, that's fine. It's just like basically like my own 8-iron anyway. Went to the next hole. He was about 210. Had a 5-iron. He said, all right, here we go. And he hits it about 10 feet. And he looked at me, said, this is going to change the game. And he never looked back. So he certainly won. He won actually some junior events with that set of clubs. I actually have it here for people to kind of look at because we did a number on those clubs for sure. And then TaylorMade, a good friend of mine who was at TaylorMade. Bryson was playing some TaylorMade clubs at the time. He said he had throwaway clubs that would kind of help us out on our quest. And so we had those clubs with the tungsten weight in the back. And we basically got a set of TaylorMades to be one length, and we got all the weights at 280 grams on the head. And he played that for a short time. Then we went to the Kingdom, and this was probably one of the greatest days of my life, to be honest with you. It was just really fun kind of proving a theory. And by the way, his dad was adamant that he was not going to be playing these one length or single length golf clubs. And we fought all the way down to San Diego about it too. I was in the front seat with him. Bryson was in the back seat doing whatever. And anyway, so we go down there, and everybody's making fun of us at the Kingdom. And I said, look, before we do anything, I want you to get your track man, and I want you to have him hit a shot from his three iron all the way down to his lob wedge. And I want you, you're going to see something you've never seen before. And their head fitter, he had Bryson do that, literally looked at me after it was over. He goes, so Bryson hit his mile per hour, 90 miles an hour on every club, all the way from three iron all the way to lob wedge. He had perfect gapping. And this guy looked at me and he said, hey, I've never seen even the best tour pros do that. And he said, give me 45 minutes. I'm going to make you a set. So they were all in at that point. They were helping us out quite a bit. And that's kind of how it all, you know, all begun, it began. And again, we had no money. So like I said, cheapest shaft I could get was a six iron dynamic gold parallel tip, in fact. So that's kind of how we started there. And then shafts and things started, we started working with different deflections and weights and so on.
So you said something just as a little follow-up. You said, I never said no. Is he hard to say no to?
Now, unfortunately, in my place, I kind of built this science-oriented place. You know, I've always said it's a science project that's gone terribly wrong. And so, you know, if it was within reason, it was easy to say, yeah, okay, let's figure it out. And I always wanted that in his quest, is that because of how he thinks and how he's motivated, you know, to say no to him would only infuriate him and say, hey, look, I'm going to go try to figure it out anyway, you know, that kind of thing. And so in my view, it was like, okay, the question was a difficult one. However, or it was an easy question, but a difficult one to figure out. But it certainly, I knew one length had been done. And so I was around when Tommy Armour tried to do their single length EQL and so on. So that kind of scared me a little bit. But there was plenty of information about what we needed to do as far as clubs. And again, all he did is he found his seven iron and go, that's my favorite club, which is pretty much like everybody's favorite club. And so he just said, look, well, I want everything to be like my seven iron, you know, and that's what we did. And you know, to me, it wasn't that out of the realm on his wedging. I've always, you know, people always criticize his wedging, but you know, my view, it's just practice. He doesn't want to practice his wedging. So there you go.
That was going to be my next question was, you know, positives and negatives with the single length. Cause you know, you read the different people come out with reports that say he's world-class, one of the best in the game with a 6, 7, 8 iron, but he's not as good with long irons and not as good as with wedges. And I've seen you on social media talk about the wedge thing. You know, go into that a little bit. So I, you know, I'll tell a little.
Right, so again, if the wedge is, you know, let's say the club is literally that much longer, right? The wedge. And so if you're telling me that ruins a wedger, that inch, and it's not this, I get it, it's only this, and then I've got some players that might only be an inch over, right? And so and you can grip down, I mean, who, you know, why, you could certainly grip down, and we'd have guys tell, oh, it's a physics problem, you know, that's why he's a bad wedger, he'd grip down and, you know, he'd go to a short way. It just was the same thing. I've always felt with him it was about practice and what he enjoyed to do. Obviously he enjoys hitting a driver for sure, trying to hit it, you know, 150 miles an hour. And he's always, you know, enjoyed stuff like that. But again, it was always a challenge to work with him on his wedging. So old school, I'm an old school guy. So guess what I would go do to help him get his wedging improved? I'd get a glove and I'd have him hit balls to me. And of course now he has an opportunity of hitting me. You know, but the reality was, you know, here I'm standing at 110 yards, hit it to me, see how good you are, right? And if I caught it, you know, and, you know, or if I didn't even move and he could hit it right into the glove, I mean, he was improving. But wedging has always been something that he, you know, he struggles with in respect that he doesn't like to actually practice it. He did set up a system. He has an amazing system, and it's a clock system, very simple, and he's very good at that. The problem that we see now is because of what he's trying to do with the distance, his acceleration is, you know, he has acceleration rates that are off a little bit. So, but what's interesting though, if you actually said, hey, Bryson, go to 9 o'clock, I mean, it's like spot on his positions, right? And so, but what you can tell he's struggling with when he's on, he's really hard to beat. But when he struggles with, because again, he's trying to hit, all he cares about is hitting it harder and harder and harder, trying to take that to its limit, that's certainly going to translate into other things. I mean, that's just a given.
So when do you, quick little follow-up on the single length, when do you decide to take a player down that route versus
every time?
So you're pushing everybody into single length.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, so from my perspective, it's still from a fitting, it's still about speed, right? And so if I have a player that, let's say top speed is only 80 miles an hour, you know, but I wouldn't give them a 4-iron anyway, right? Not probably wouldn't even give them a 5-iron. So that's when we go hybrid and some other things, maybe a lofted wood and so on. But if you're at 90, let's say 90, we always felt that 90 was the kind of the magic number that would give you that ability to hit on one length, depending on the shaft, that ability to hit a 4-iron or 3-iron all the way through lob wedge. So that was kind of a key. But again, I did that with normal fitting anyway. And so the other part about the fitting aspect is that when you're fitting, especially with Cobra, one length, you're fitting a 9-iron, a 7-iron, and a 5-iron. You can't do that in any other, you know, unless you're at a really high-end fitting location. But what's really cool is to be able to test a 9-iron with the proper shaft, the 7-iron proper shaft, and then a 5-iron proper shaft. So it's a very cool and great fitting experience. And that the guy doesn't want one length, which is fine. I've got that. I got juniors that don't want that because their parents maybe don't want to go that down that road. We still fit them in the 7-iron. So we know the shaft. It's pretty simple. We know the lie angle, lofts, and whatever that needs to be done. And we do that.
Pal, any thoughts on that?
Well, this is foreign to me. So, right. You know, as so I've gotten older, I feel like my wedges do need to be longer because my arms are shorter or I for whatever reason, you know, I think it might be a little easier for me to have a little bit longer club, but I never really tried it. So I can't speak to it really.
Right. It's just like hitting your 7-iron all day long is really all it amounts to in my mind from a baseline perspective. Again, the wedge, if I'm just looking at stock shots, not floppers around the green and all that, but I believe a longer wedge to do all those little specialty shots gives you an option. The other thing too, is that the head weights are a little lighter. So you can create more speed in a bunker and you can spin the ball much better. Because you can create a little more speed because the head is a tad lighter. So there are some possibilities there that if you just kind of get out of the box, and that's the hard part with everybody. It's the hard part is the fact that it's Bryson. Okay. Bryson's clubs, super upright. He's got the big giant grips, right? His swing is a little bit funky and he wears the stupid hat, not the Puma hat, the flat cap, right? And so you have all those things put together in every, and I've even gone in golf shots and they don't know who I am because I'm definitely a nobody and literally ask them about one length clubs and they go, oh, you got to swing like Bryson to hit those, which is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. But those are some of the myths that are out there.
Mike, one of the things, I mean, I'm tall, I'm 6'7", and I've gone 2 inches over with my wedges. So my wedges are on my 9-iron length, and it's helped me a ton with the soft little pitch shot that, you know, you want to use the bounce. Cause I'd always been over too much. And to me, the shorter club, it's easier to dig the leading edge in. So I completely agree with that. One of the things that I tell everybody with spending time with you guys is how awesome you handled Bryson. And what I mean, and I tell everybody too, like, I mean, Bryson was awesome with me, like super respectful. I kind of pissed him off when I spilled Coke on his clubs and his Tesla. Other than that, we had a great relationship. Yeah. But he was incredible, but he was also difficult at times, just as far as like, when he'd ask for my opinion and I'd give it to him, I had to back it up. Like, I really had to back it up. And one of the things, I tell the story, the first time we met was at Colonial, and it was Wednesday night, and he'd been punting for a while, getting the vector stuff down. And then we go to the back of the range, and it's like 5:30, 6 o'clock on Wednesday, and he tees off at 9 or 8:30 the next morning. And you know, we had a full body 3D system, and he wanted me to suit him up and give him everything. And you were sitting back, kind of hanging out, not really like right on top of him. And you know, I always loved the freedom that you gave him to kind of explore. My question to you is, how did you come up with that? When did you realize that this kid was special, like super talented, special, and you had to handle him differently than you would have handled other students?
Well, he spent about 30 hours a week with me from the time he was 12 until he left for college. So my environment it's probably like your academy now, where kids are there more often and hang out, so you get a chance to know them. I was never in this to make a lot of money, because I believed in coaching, and at that point, you know, I couldn't charge a lot of money. I would charge a small fee, and the kids could be here all day long, and that's what I did, because I felt that was best. You know, that was a better way to improve. And so Bryson, I think more or less he was different from day one. I mean, you knew he was super smart. That was pretty easy. From the moment I saw him, I mean, he was a ball beater. He loves hitting golf balls. I mean, he'd hit golf balls for 10 hours if he could, which he did a lot of. And he spent tons of time on the video. And so he would look at something, what he wanted, what he didn't want, what he didn't like. He would always be saying, "Mike, Mike, 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 you know, come look, come watch," which he still did that for a long period of time. You know, even when he turned pro. And so, you know, he'll say all the time, the reason I turned out the way I turned out is because of Mike, in respect, you know, because again, I'm not going to give him, I found that it was better that I let him dig it out of the dirt than me tell him, here's what I believe, because he'd fight that anyway. I might mention something, right? Or I put you in the mix, sorry. And you would give him data. And so that data would just show what I would say would be the truth, you know, whatever he was trying to work on. And, you know, and then he could disseminate that from there and figure out what did he want to incorporate, you know, that would, you know, would biomechanically, that would make, you know, make the ball do what he wanted to do.
So when he was growing up around the academy there, how did he interact with the other kids, and how did they interact with him?
You know, he was pretty good. And I mean, obviously there were times that were rough, but I think that's because they're friends. And, you know, some of them probably like brothers and sisters. And so, you know, I've seen him get angry, but I've seen them get angry at him too. So I think he was also, though, a leader. He was a very good leader. And there was a couple of kids that I had that started late that literally just wanted to mimic what he was doing. So whether that was the golf swing or his schedule, his junior golf schedule or whatever, they were trying to mimic that.
Talk to us.
So we were, again, we came, this is not a big time, you know, there's plenty of money around, that's for sure. But he didn't come from a lot of money. And so our junior, the junior tournaments that he was playing in were Northern California junior golf stuff. That was about it. You know, he played well in the state high school championship, played well in the junior world, and then qualified and played okay in the U.S. junior. But that's all we were able to do. They never played an HAGA event. I think maybe one that was maybe in San Francisco, and that was about it.
What did he teach you throughout this process as far as handling elite players?
Well, I really believe we were totally unprepared for what we experienced on tour. You know, especially because of where he, you know, he was so unique that he won the AM, won the NCAA. He was a unique figure. Everybody wanted to play with him or talk to him and all that. There was a lot going on. And so I was kind of bodyguard, protector, try to be coach. You know, again, he missed 22, 23 cuts, maybe more in a 2-year process. I think people forget that. And I'm telling you what, man, what that does to the psyche, was brutal. You know, he lost his card after the first year. And so I think the biggest thing from a perspective in our relationship, it was just doing my best to be there and to somehow make sure he was fulfilling his goal, which, you know, he wanted to be a successful tour player. He wanted to be number one. I mean, he still wants to be number one. There's no doubt about that. And I think that again, like I said, traveling, all those things, we were totally unprepared. New clubs, new, you know, all this stuff, too many, lots of stuff going on. And so on. And so we had to rely on each other. I had to let him be pretty vocal if he was upset. I always told him, you can be mad at me, you can vent on me. I just prefer it to not be in public. If you need that, I want you to be free to that. If you need to just unload when we're in the car, go ahead. And there were a lot of those days, you know. So all that had to, was on the fly, you know, for the most part. I think from a teacher standpoint, I'm a golfing machine guy, even though I'm not an authorized golfing machine guy. And yet I've relied on the golfing machine and as my model for, you know, what I do and teach, but I've been around great instructors. And so I try to incorporate, I try to learn. I want to learn, you know. Hal Sutton, one of my favorite golfers on the planet, was fortunate. He spoke at the USAM in 82 or 83. That was a million years ago, you know, and the great player that he was. And, you know, again, I remember that. And that, you know, that's when we were hitting Balata balls in Persimmon Woods at Olympic Club at 30 degrees. Oh, man, I don't know what those guys would do with that club. And so, I think it, that's what I instilled in him, is to keep learning. And so one of the things too, for me, was if I didn't have the answer, I would reach out to people like you, Chase. And so, you know, I don't have all the answers. There's no way I do. And so when I reached out to the Sick Boys for his putter, you for, you know, for measurement, for a measurement device, an expert in your field, I was like, you know, I need that. I don't, like I said, and I've always done that with him. And if that meant that I'm out of the picture, that's the way it had to be. That's fine, because it was about him. It was never going to be about me.
You did such an awesome, when I was out there, this was after he got his card back, but had missed, was still kind of on that, still struggling a little bit. And there was just some pressure. And to me, you were the firefighter the whole time, putting out fires anywhere you could. I mean, anywhere you could. And yeah, Hal and I have talked a lot, and Hal's talked a lot about just that the first couple of years on tour and how stressful and how all the issues that come with that. And then to be put right in the limelight like he was, I mean, and how he was, I can't tell how many instructors, how many people that I respected would message me when they saw me out there and say, he's never going to make it swinging this way. He's never going to do it. Right. And the thing that was always so impressive with me, I always questioned his speed. What's funny now, questioning his speed, but right, I always questioned right his speed, the way he did it, you know, very,
right,
you know, not overloading anything, like very, very taking the hands out and all that stuff. But then I remember at the back of Colonial, I mean, he hit 120, 122 club head speed. And I was like, oh, this kid's different. Right. And at that point I was like, okay, he's going to make right it.
It was funny. I did a podcast last week with Terry Hashimoto, who invented the body track, you know, and, you know, of course everybody, you know, the center of mass, make sure it moves right to left. And you get Bryson on it when he was, when we were first starting on tour. Now, obviously, you know, he's moving because he's trying to hit so far, but the reality was that dot didn't move. And everybody that was expert in weight movements, Quan, you can't play golf that way. Why not? Right. And so Bryson, in our view, was how it was always about making it simpler. It was never about making it complicated, even though he's a very complicated individual. Right. But the reality was, it was like, well, this would be simpler to do. And so if I don't have weight movement, if I could keep it all on my, and he wasn't a center pivot guy, he was all on his left axis or hip joint. He could literally up to, you know, I mean, a driver, it would move a little bit, but for the most part with his baseline, that dot did not move, and he could rotate around that extremely fast. I've always believed in big time hip participation, and that made it easier. He had tremendously fast hand and arm speed. You know, it was easy to do. Every time we allowed it to go lateral, man, dispersion went everywhere, you know, and so on. And so you know, once he kind of figured out that this was simple and it translated from club to club to club, you know, he'd hit, you know, 10,000 seven irons, but in his mind, doesn't matter. Driver, wedge, it's all the same.
Hal?
So, I've always thought that true champions and true leaders had their own way. They had their own way of thinking, and they didn't deviate much from that. Even when, like you said, he had to be convinced to do something different. I was pretty strong in that way myself. I had my own idea about how I did it. I've loosened up a lot. Chase will tell you that I've loosened up a lot, but I was curious about the teaching world. I was curious as to where the swing was going. And, but I'm sure Bryson was that way. I'm sure he was like, convince me why I need to do it your way or whatever.
Right. That's why I never went down the, this is, you know, we certainly started at Impact. What do we want to do at Impact? What does Impact look like? And how do you want it to be? Once he really kind of, we talked about re-engineering it from there. So once he started from there, then that's when he started building the motion the way he wanted it. And so it was pretty simple. I mean, he took his 24 components in the golf machine and just wrote them down and said, that's what I want to do. Okay, you own it. It's yours. And we made some modifications over time and so on and how he applied it. But, you know, that was kind of what he did. And he really hasn't. If you look at some of it, let's say him hitting a, you know, like a 130 yard shot, it really doesn't look too different from what he was 5 years ago, even though he might have a little bit more radial deviation or wrist cock or whatever, because again, he's trying to load so much in driving. But there's a lot of similarities that he really hasn't, you know, deviated too far from for the most part.
Mike, talk about, you know, he gets all the notoriety for the driving distance and all the stuff he's done over, you know, post COVID and what he's done here recently.
But right.
Talk about his putting. Did you say it drives you crazy?
Yeah, it drives me crazy. Yeah. He's what I would say might be the best putter in the world, to be honest with you. It pretty darn close for sure.
One of the last trips when I was out there in Fresno, he was battling with the side saddle stuff and battling the USGA. And I mean, ball striking wise, all of his stats during that time, you know, this was right before he won and then made it in the British Open and all that stuff. But all of his stats said he was a great ball striker, but the putting was weak. And then sure. The arm lock has just transformed his game. So talk about that a bit.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, it was funny when he was here last December, he took out his putter, his face on putter. He goes, you know, I putted pretty dang good with this thing. And, you know, and he just looked, he goes, man, USGA was just not going to let me putt that way, you know, and they were pretty adamant and that was the battle we were having from week to week. And so that's going to get in your psyche when you're not sure anything you bring out, right, that they're going to approve. And so, once that was over, it was funny. He called me after Valspar, I think it was. And I wasn't out there that week. And he goes, what am I going to do about my putting? And I said, well, you know, do you want to go back to David Adele? And he goes, no, I can't do that. That relationship, you know, unfortunately is just not there. You want to go to Bettinardi? You want to go Scotty Cameron? What do you want to do? And he goes, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, why not, you know, you remember meeting Steve Harrison from SICK. And I said, you know, their face technology, I really like, I really dig. And they're kind of like us, you know, they're a bunch of poor boys trying to, you know, figure out putting. And I said, you could go spend 3 or 4 days with them and they'll build you whatever you want. Right. And he looks at me or he says to me on the phone, he says, well, that's 2 hours away. That's too far away. We just missed the cut on Friday with like strokes gain -5. Right. And I said, what else do you have to do? Maybe you need that nice drive 2 hours to Orlando, right? I thought it was hilarious that I had to convince him to do this. But, and again, and so anyway, he decides to drive up, spends 3 or 4 days with him. He literally called me, was so excited about what he had figured out. And then coming out and then, you know, together collaborating with this arm lock putter. And so that was the beginning. And then Steven came on tour quite a bit. He's a great putting instructor, which I loved having him out. His brother Greg was out as well. So there was a nice, you know, team there. And that really helped boost Bryson's improvement in putting. You know, the I'm not sure if I should probably share that there's a tidbit from Tiger that I don't think anybody knows about. I don't know if I can share that. So I thought I'd tease you with that one. Oh, yeah. But anyway, one of the things that, it was one of the coolest moments, by the way, Tiger saying something that it was like, you could tell everybody shut up, Tiger's speaking. And he's going to give you gold. So anyway, and I'll relate it this way before the story. I'm not sure if I have permission to say that story. So Bryson was struggling still with he was certainly improving his putting. I think he was like, you know, maybe 50th or 60th in putting, which is certainly better. But he started discovering that he couldn't figure out why the role characteristics were changing from week to week. And so he finally figured out that launch on a particular surface was everything. And so it was really funny. So we're at Quail Hollow and we're getting on the green and he goes, okay, listen. So he puts it. He goes, did you hear it? It went, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. Because I don't want to hit that. So it's another one. Do you hear that one? It went, right? He goes, that's what I want it to be. That changed everything with him, is that learning that launch characteristics have to change because he's putting on different surfaces from week to week, but he knew what he wanted, right? And then hence Tiger made a comment, Bryson, you know what I call that? I call that the sauce. That's what he said to Bryson. Now, there's a little more to the story, but I don't want to lead on that, but I will give you that. It was one of the coolest moments, everything. Tiger was paying attention to the whole thing. So he knew that was major, major in improving plotting. And so Bryson felt, man, that's the final frontier, is how I control launch on different surfaces. And so that was his quest. He worked his butt off in putting. I mean, he worked everything you're seeing how hard he's working in long drive. He worked just as hard, if not harder, on his putting, because he really went on a quest to figure out all the nuances of putting. Even though he didn't have control over the ball after it left the putter, but he did figure out I can have more control than what he thought. That's for sure. And that's, that's the quest. One of the quests. There's some other things, obviously speed control, some other things that he does. Again, sets up a really good system about the length of stroke and acceleration. But again, you know, he worked his butt off to become the putter that he is today.
Well, he's certainly a good putter. So no doubt. Were you on board with his change, his quest for distance that he's been on?
Yeah, well, when he first said he was going to do it, I said, well, I love it. And I said, but potentially your strokes gained will go down, not up. And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you're going to hit it farther, right? He goes, yeah. You're going to be hitting it into your weakest zone. Are you going to actually practice those shots and become better at those shots? He goes, well, maybe over in time. And which proved me right. The other thing too, I said, the good news is that you can only hit, when you're hitting a driver 340, you can only hit it so many times. So you're going to be hitting your 3-wood or 5-wood a lot. I'll give you that all day long, because you're going to hit more fairways. Again, I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm an old school guy. Fairways and greens to me over time, it wins. It wins. Yeah. It wins. Yeah. I know you got to be a great putter too, but it's so important to me, fairways and greens. Well, obviously I give him a 5-wood over a driver. I would imagine he'll hit that in the fairway more often than his driver and so on. So I certainly, yep, you can hit driver, bang it down there in the rough and have a 40-yard shot out of the rough. But again, are you going to be able to get that close versus, let's say, an 8-iron or 9-iron that's back in the fairway? So, you know, again, I know there's trade-offs and so on. The other thing too was, as long as he had supervision, and I was all in, because Greg Roscoff at MAT, Muscle Activation Technique, was supervising the whole thing, making sure that he doesn't get hurt. Bryson's always been pretty good about if something aches or hurt, not that he's a hypochondriac, but I think a lot of elite athletes are hypochondriacs. He's always good about when something hurts, shutting it down immediately. He doesn't overdo something. And so far he hasn't been hurt at all. And again, I mean, I asked him, is there a limit to this whole thing? And he looked at me and said, nope. Right. I said, and I jokingly said, so is the goal just to drive evergreen? Yeah. Okay. All right. You know, I mean, again, it's, you know, you can't say no. You know, if the potential is there, he's going to try to take it to the limit.
Do you worry about injury? I mean, and that was going to be my follow-up because of all the MAT stuff. And I tell people, like, this has kind of been a little bit in the works for a while. You guys have been trying to get the body right. Maybe not quite to this level was the expectation, but.
Well, you know, we always had what we called the crank ball. The problem was he was not big enough to sustain it. So the weight gain, muscle mass, getting stronger, a lot of that was because in his brain, he needs to be very stable. He has to be stable, right? And so if he's feeling wobbly, and again, when you're swinging at high speeds and you're kind of a thinner guy, you're not able to sustain that structure that, you know, can be consistent. And so that was, you know, some of the things he told me at one point, thank God he's not doing it. About a year and a half ago, his goal was to try to get to 270. I thought, you got to be kidding. I told him, look at me, dude. That's what you want to look like? You're kidding me, right? And so he's tapered that way back. So, you know, he looks good right now. He looks great.
What do you think about the challenge of long drive versus playing golf?
Well, I don't think most people know this, is that drivers are not made typically to be over 125, 130 miles an hour. So there is that dilemma. And so I did a podcast and tried to explain when the driver suck comment kind of thing, in that Bryson wasn't saying that the driver's bad and Cobra's bad or whatever. What he's saying is that, and again, when I talked to the Cobra guys, he's changing so fast. So in other words, he's at, let's say 135 mile an hour club head speed. He's like bumping it to 137 really fast. So they're trying to make the product for him where he is at the moment. That's very, very difficult considering how fast he's changing. And so they were talking about there's like 27 parameters that they're trying to fix or work on, and they might get two or three, but some of the others are not functional. And again, when you're at high speed, you know, he's at what, 145 now with club head speed. And if he wants to rip that out, when he's playing, and the driver won't perform because it's not made to go that high speed, it's not a long driver club, that makes it very difficult. Now, I will say, some of the new product that they're coming out with, I think they're pretty close, and I'm pretty impressed. And I think even, you know, maybe Bryson's impressed too as well. He's been literally playing a club that's 5 years old, you know, the old LTD.
What do you think about the USGA and the, you know, trying to curtail some of the distance stuff?
Well, they're just going to make the driver shorter. I mean, it's not going to matter to him, you know. I mean, it's going to make everybody, quote, potentially shorter. So unless they limit the face and limit the ball, you know, which maybe that's the direction they're going to end up going. I don't know. My view is that if they set up the golf course differently, right, in my mind, instead of the rough being this way, the rough needs to be this way from green back. The closer you get to the green, the higher the rough should become and a little bit tighter. And so that makes, to me, that brings everybody back into the game in my mind. And so, all right, so Bryson wants to drive it up there by the green at 420 yards or 30 yards or whatever, but if he misses the fairway and he's in rough, like that, okay, so now the guy back that laid up to a six iron, maybe it's equal now, right? So to me, it's wrong doing it this way. They need to be doing it this way now, and until that's done, they're going to keep trying to go to equipment. I think that's crazy, because the guys will figure it out, unless they like totally limit the club on the COR and some of the other things.
Hal, thoughts on the rough stuff?
Well, I'm an old school guy as well. I believe fairways and greens win, and are certainly give you a chance to win all the time. And, you know, I've been a proponent. I've said if the ball would spin a little bit more, it would be a lot better. You know, the hardest shot in the world to hit is a 120-yard shot that's pins on the front of the green, winds blowing 30 into you, and there's a hazard right there in front. That used to put the fear in most guys because they couldn't get on top of it, pinch it, and keep it down.
Right.
And you're shaking your head yes, because you know that shot. 100%. These guys today don't really know that shot very much. And, you know, that was the guy that could do that had a little bit of an advantage back in those days. And, you know, I'd like to see the ball curve more than it does right now. And if they put some spin in the ball, it'll curve more. And mm-hmm. that would subdue a lot of the guys that are really trying to chase distance. If all of a sudden that thing's going to start curving more out there at that distance, that's going to make them think differently.
No doubt. Yeah, let them hit a blotta ball that's not round, you know?
Yeah.
Right? That's how good you were. I mean, you could hit it pretty good with a ball that wasn't even necessarily round or stayed round very long.
Well, we changed our balls often back then. You know, yeah. I'd go through a half a dozen balls a day. And that's if I'd, you know, hit it solid all day long.
Right.
You know, unless you put a blemish on one or something. Now I doubt that. I don't know how many. What is it? What does he change? Every six holes or?
Oh, no, he'll play it. Shoot, he'll play a ball 14, 15 holes.
Really?
He's crazy that way.
As hard as he does.
Might be a little less now, but I mean, he's always been one that, hey, if it's not scuffed, I'll keep playing it unless he doesn't like it, you know, for whatever reason. So you got to remember too, we balance the golf ball. So, you know, so to for us, being that he's going to play a ball longer than most, that we wanted to make sure where we knew where the CG was in the golf ball. And so, you know, once we got to the point where we could play the ball where we knew where it was balanced and so on, as long as there wasn't scuff mark on it, yeah, you could play it all 18 holes if you wanted to.
So is there any chance of him of it becoming out of balance while he's playing?
You know, I thought about that because of the, you know, the collision that's there. We talked to the ball guys and they've said, well, first of all, the ball is only good for 40 hits anyway at best. And so you got to kind of think of that a little bit. So if it's deteriorating, you know, to 40 shots, you know, and you're hitting, what, 30 in a round, then, yeah, I would probably say that it should be taken out of play a little bit sooner than later. But I don't know. I don't think he's really kind of thought about that per se as much. And I know he's figured out and understood some things about the dimples, but if he knows if his ball is balanced and he's feeling like it's good and it's in, he's playing as long as possible.
I lost that bet. I would have bet he would have changed balls a lot sooner than that.
Yeah, no, not that he's superstitious. I don't think it's that, you know. I think maybe growing up as a kid, it's like, you know, I don't have the money to go play 10 balls in a round, you know. I'm going to play one ball, and, you know, if it's still round and not scuffed, then I'm playing it all 18 if I can.
So, Mike, talk real quick about how you guys balance the golf balls and the importance of that.
So, it's old school again. We soak it in Epsom salt, ball below the level of water, the water level, and the heavy side will flip to the bottom. It'll float in the water, but it'll flip. You'll see it. It'll flip. So that means the CG is not in the center. I've only really found, I don't know, maybe two or three balls where the ball would just sit in the Epsom salt and just spin, which was pretty cool because that meant that the CG was dead center. And so how we then measure it is then we would put a piece of lead tape on the top of about 60 milligrams, put it back in the water, and if it flipped over, right, then that would be a playable ball. If I had to put two 60-gram pieces of lead tape to make it flip, that ball was out. So being that Bridgestone was great, sent us lots of golf balls, that I really made it tight. I think it was, I tried to do it at 50 milligrams. So when it, cause I used to balance all those golf balls. And so if it flipped at 50, boom, it was in. If it halfway or just barely moved, I'd throw it out. And we would get about 10, probably 10 out of the 12 balls that were really good. If I was at 80 milligrams to flip it, it would be a lot different, which is, that would be for a normal person. That's like you and I playing golf would be fine. But I've had balls that it took 240 milligrams of lead tape to flip on.
Wow.
So think about that for a second. So we know that that's going to make it. And by the way, so we were, just to validate this, we were at Oakmont and we were rolling a ball. It was balanced at the 50 milligram. So it was really a good ball. We were rolling it with its spin axis straight up and down, right? And it was rolling dead straight, dead straight, dead straight. We moved the spin axis, the CG, at 90 degrees to the spin axis. It rolled 10 inches offline. Think about that for a second. So if you're changing your golf ball, excuse me, every hole, no big deal. It's just random, right? You would be fine. Maybe every other hole would be fine. But a guy like Bryson, who potentially is going to play it for 10, 12 holes, and he had a ball that was out of round, or that was the CG was off, it could pull, make a putt go to the right. And he has said to me, I don't know how many times, because of his ball being balanced, making that putt at John Deere was because his golf ball on the last hole was because his golf ball was balanced.
Interesting. Do you find that the golf balls are better now than when you guys first started doing this?
Well, from a tour, yeah, but not, no, or about the same. It's impossible to get the CG in the center. I mean, they're making millions of golf balls. It's just impossible. So, and like I said, here's what happens. So if I take a dozen golf balls, I'm going to get probably 2 to 3 of those golf balls where the CG is 90 degrees to the spin axis. Potentially it's going to be over 80, because again, I'm buying it off the shelf or whatever. Potentially it's going to be 80 milligrams or higher, right, to flip it over correctly. And so if you just discover those golf balls, I would say, you know, throw them out. Most the CG is going to be close. Like if you have a, you know, the Titleist, let's say on top of the ball, you mark it right on that little, you know, whatever the arrow is, and you roll that. I would say 70% of the time, it's going to be fairly close to that line. And so it'll be fine. So, but if, here's my point. If you're using one ball and you're using it for a long period of time, I am telling you, and I've seen it, and you're trying to hit a straight putt and the CG is off that spin axis or roll axis, you might miss that putt. Might not have been you. Might have been the fact that the gravity was pulling it in a direction.
So you're the first person that I've heard that actually put some weight on the ball. Like what do you think about the test where you put it up to the solid, it spins around, you put a dot at where it comes up and you spin it again. You're shaking your head. No, you don't like it.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't. All you're going to find maybe where the, you know, where the high, the, where you should mark the ball, you're not going to discover where the heavy side or the light side is.
Okay.
So unfortunately the CG, I've had guys that are, you know, ball companies, kind of startups that are trying to do this, you know, they'll call me and say, hey man, you got to see this ball. You got to see this ball. It's kind of been interesting to see people trying, but again, balls then will get very expensive.
Interesting stuff. How think about all the balls you played and how off all those wound balls were over the course of years.
So I was just patting myself on the back for having a pretty good career with all of the inferior equipment that I played with all my life.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you know, I heard stories that Hogan used to put Epsom salt in his bathtub and put all his golf balls in there, you know, and so that's how he would balance it and so on. And like I said, if you're throwing balls out every other hole, then, you know, then I think you'd be fine and so on. It wouldn't matter too much. Although, again, a ball, Callaway did tell us that they did some testing that it would make a ball curve offline for sure.
Well, that's what I was going to follow up and ask you, if you guys did any iron Byron testing with Cobra or anything to see what the difference was.
More like I said, it was pre ball deal. And so, cause some of the companies were really fascinated by what we were doing. And so Callaway was pretty, they didn't tell us all the info cause we were asking them. So they said at like 180 yards or something, they said a ball could go offline 3 to 5 yards. And I said, so how off center was it? They wouldn't tell me. How much was it off center in respect to weight? Wouldn't tell me. So, you know, whatever. So, but they did do the testing.
So, go ahead, Hal. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, mine's going to be kind of a segue to a bigger question. So go.
Okay. So let me ask something here right now. When I was coming up and playing the tour early on, I always blamed me first. I didn't blame the equipment. I didn't blame you if you were my coach. I blame me because ultimately I had to be responsible when I went out there. That's one of the things that I loved about golf was you know, I got all the credit or I got all the blame. Right. And, you know, when you become really good, you don't think you can ever make a mistake. So you blame most of the other people. So I tried to put myself into a habit of blaming me first. And do you find that today or not? What do you, I mean, you're telling me about all these things that you, to the outside, like, you know, a CG being off or whatever else.
I think, you know, in respect to Bryson, it was always, if it was something that was going to influence what the ball was going to do, he was very fascinated by all the nuances. I mean, he was a physics major in college. I mean, I thought he was crazy for doing that, but he did it. And so he's always been one to be very inquisitive, you know, about, you know, when we saw him spraying water on the ball, what does that do? You know? And so he has that science in his mind, you know, okay, well, wait a minute. That's going to affect how I hit the ball. Maybe I should study that and find out why. And then, you know, for him, if he didn't know something, and that's probably when he's at his heart, when he's hard on himself or hard on those around him, it's when he's in that discovery mode. And so, you know, he's trying to find the answer. Mike, do you have the answer? How do you have the answer? No, we're not. No. And he gets frustrated. You can see it get amped up. And everybody's witnessed to that multiple times. And so, but that's his, you know, he's trying to discover something, you know, and trying to find an answer to something. And so a lot of times when he did blame himself, in the end, it was something else. And so, you know, it was easier in the beginning probably to blame self. And until, I always said this, once he got on tour and he wasn't in school and he had 6 hours of study at night, I'm going, holy crap, what's he going to fill that void with, right? And so, and again, he filled it with all the nuances of golf. And so whether it was the way a club was made or whether it was the way a shaft kicked, torqued, and whatever, or how a ball reacted on the surface and all that kind of stuff, it just, you know, he just felt like, hey, I got to understand it. How about, you know, the greens are hard by on a certain location and soft in others. You know, he would say, I should know that information, you know? And so when he didn't, and then something happened, that's when he would be upset. We got to figure out how to solve that problem. So it's always for him, it's always been just solve the problem, you know? And so, I think he, you know, certainly when he's made mistakes, it's, you know, it's hard on himself for sure. But it's also easy to be targets as well.
The one thing about great players, and how's like this too, is Bryson is very inquisitive, and we had lots of late night phone calls about wrist angles and maxing out range of motion and hitting in range is what he'd always like to say.
Yeah.
It was always interesting, and you're always on edge to see what question he was going to ask and where he was going to go next. So I'm gonna put you on the spot a little bit, and you can go as deep into this as you want to, but there were you guys after he won, where was his first win again? John Deere. Yeah. John Deere. After you won John Deere, he went to the British and struggled at the British. You had the late night range session. And you told me a little backstory. Well,
that was the second year. Okay. So that was the first year.
So there's a funny story that happened after that range session, and you are more than welcome to say, no, you don't want to get into it, but it was kind of an interesting story that you told me at the PGA show. And I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Which part?
About you having to make your way back to your hotel room.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, that was at Carnoustie. And so on Thursday night, and it was pretty, not that it was getting out of hand, but it was getting out of hand. We were trying to get him to shut down. He just wasn't going to do it. And so things got a little more personal than I had anticipated or wanted at that moment. And so I was done. And so it was two things, either I was going to kill him or I better leave. And so, you know, sometimes I regret, I wish maybe it would have been interesting to have stayed. I'm just not that kind of person. I mean, certainly didn't want to embarrass him or whatever, but I mean, if I got to take him down on the ground, I was going to take him down on the ground. So, and so on. And so, you know, what I did that night was I decided to leave. It was like 9:30, 10. And we were still on that range hitting balls. And anyway, but I didn't have a ride back to my house. And so I got lost. And so my phone didn't have the global, I had the direction, but I didn't know where, which way to go. And I was literally standing on a street corner going, do I go that way or do I go that way? And right at that moment, a red taxi pulls up and I stop him. I, you know, told him, hey man, I need help getting home. And, you know, I got the address, but I don't know where this place is. And the guy's like a Scottish Pakistani guy. I mean, I had no idea how to understand what he was saying when he was talking. And anyway, so it literally was around the corner where the house was. So, but I left my iPad in his taxi. And so, and I couldn't find him. I gave him cash because I didn't have any, you know, I had only had US money. So I got no receipts. And so we went on a quest to try to find this guy, couldn't find him. And I mean, we used every resource we possibly could because had all the golf swings. In fact, I'm, by the way, I'm on that iPad right now. It has all those swings. So anyway, went through the weekend, Bryson made the cut, whatever. You know, it was terrible. What would have been a $5 cab ride, I think it, I thought it was looking at costing me about 10,000, you know? And so, came back home. About 2 weeks later, I get a phone call. It's the taxi guy. I knew that voice anywhere, right? And he goes, are you Bryson DeChambeau's coach? And I go, yes. He goes, I have your iPad. I go, I know. He goes, that was my last ride that night. I went on vacation or holiday. So he parked his van in front of his house and nobody, you know, nobody used it for 10 days, right? And here's the best part about this story. He goes, I'm not a golfer. I don't know anything. My son is a big time golfer. He opens the iPad and it's still on video of Bryson swinging. Right. And his son goes, this has to be the coach of Bryson DeChambeau. Right. Cause he kind of told him that night what happened. And I ended up getting my iPad back about 2 weeks later and we gave him a little tip and we were pretty happy. And like I said, I'm on the iPad right now.
Some more of the story, I guess, is just to use the iCloud to back up all your
Time. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just not that smart. Bryson would tell you that for sure.
I got one last question for you. What's one thing you'd like the world to know about Bryson that they don't know?
You know, he loves children. So I think that I think he's asked me a number of times. He said, do you think I'd be a good father? And, you know, and I've always felt that get him away from all this stuff and he ends up, you know, finding the right person, have a family that I think he would be a really good father. I think he loves kids. He loves hanging out with them. I think you can kind of see that when you look at his YouTube or TikTok and all that stuff. You know, and I think that, you know, get him away from all this. It's amazing to me how much interest he'll take in the kids and what they're doing, their school or golf swing, or what are they trying to do in their game or whatever. He becomes very, very interested in that. And I think people miss that. They see him as this aloof, weird, whatever, you know, and that when he has come home, which we call this home, you know, and there's lots of kids around that he's known for many, many years. Some have grown up now, but he becomes Bryson. That's all they think of. It's just Bryson, you know, it's nothing more, nothing less, it's just Bryson. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I feel like people just don't know about.
It's awesome stuff, Mike. Well, again, I tell everybody, I think you did a world-class job with him. I mean, he's, like, thanks, I man. Said, he was awesome with me. I don't think I need to defend him, but he's gotten some bad scrutiny in the media from different things and different times. But he was, I mean, I enjoyed, you know, battling it out with you guys for a year and a half or 2 years, however long it was. And I always tend to say, man, he's a really good kid and he means really well. He's just very competitive and kind of wears his emotions on his sleeve a little bit. And sometimes it's gotten the best of him, but you guys treated me so well. And I learned a lot working with him and being careful what I say to tour players and that kind of stuff. Like, it was a good learning experience for me, but I, I really think you were the perfect coach for him to get him to where he's gotten to. I really believe that.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that a lot more than you probably know. So, you know, it's good to be back home. I'm relaxing home, teaching, getting our academy. It's been rolling. COVID, I think in some ways was good maybe for golf and so on. You know, we're excited about the future. I got some really amazing young kids coming up and looking forward to seeing what they do.
Hal, take us home.
Mike, we appreciate you being on the show. You know, you've given us some insight into one of the most interesting guys in golf right now. You know, he's challenging the game in many, many ways. We all are anxious to see where all this takes him. And we appreciate your insight. I know I echo what Chase said. Bryson seemed like a really nice young man, and you probably had a lot of influence on him. So you spent a lot of time with him.
Yeah, so, definitely tried. That's for sure. So we consider him family. That's for sure.
Well, and that's what it ends up being. The guy I worked with mostly on my golf swing, you know, he was a second father to me, really. And I still talk to him to this day. And I'm sure Bryson will always do the same with you. So thanks for being on Be the Right Club today. And we look forward to getting you on again.
Be the right club today. Yes!